Backyard Green Films is proud to present this episode of Agriculture with your host, Alara Bowman. Alara and her husband, Rick, travel throughout the land in their travel trailer, which they have nicknamed Bessie, bringing you stories about their travels and the people they meet. They visit farmers, ranchers, and just about anyone who loves putting their hands in the dirt or their feet in stirrups. In those travels, they have gotten to meet some very interesting people. Here's one of those interviews.
Hi, this is Alara. Welcome back to our podcast. We're back on the East Coast of the United States, getting ready for the enjoyable mad rush of the New York State Sheep and Wool Festival in Rhinebeck. There's a nip in the air here. The leaves have dropped completely in some places, and they're just past the peak in others. Rain and odd weather have played havoc with Mother Nature's normal schedule in this area, but you can definitely tell that summer's left us. And we might just get a bit more rain in the festival this weekend, or so the weatherman says. I guess I better buy some more woolen products this weekend just in case, right, honey? Rick? Where'd you go? I don't know why he leaves the room so fast sometimes. Anyway, every year on this recurring trip eastward, one thing we love to do before we dive into the whirlwind is to visit farms and people in the fiber industry in the surrounding area, with hopes of maybe meeting up with them yet again at the festival. Our own little fiber shed moment. To trace something from the sheep to the shawl, as they say. It's kind of like visiting the breed barns at Rhinebeck to talk to the critters before you hit the big vendor hallways. This week's podcast is one of those pre-festival visits. As we mentioned last week, a kind referral is the reason we got a chance to visit Lunan Bay Cashmere in Scotland and walk those green pastures with the glorious salt breeze blowing through our hair way over there on the other side of the pond. Okay, Rick, so it's blowing through your beard anyway. Why does he keep leaving? What did I say? Our stay at Hulse Hill Farms B&B was one of the more peaceful and beautiful visits we've experienced since we've started our manure-rich life adventure. And when I say peace and beauty, it was like you took an episode of Martha Stewart and you stuck it on steroids. Or a tranquilizer. I don't know which one is more applicable here. We spent 3 nights in the cute and cozy tiny home on the hill. And it's no wonder she's been featured on HGTV. We were first greeted at the door by a basket of supplies, which included fresh berries and pastries. We ventured in and oohed and awed over the bed in the loft and the bed in the alcove and the smartly designed bathroom and shower and the composting toilet, all surrounded by pure white shiplap. The little couch had soft cotton throws, and it was right across from a flat-screen TV, which I was resigned to, but Rick was thrilled by, because apparently there's some kind of playoff going on right now. Go figure. But there was a full kitchen in our new home away from home, with goat-embossed plates to boot. On the counter was a beautiful bouquet of fresh flowers, and croissants, and a little box of farm-fresh eggs from the chicken coop we passed on the way up the hill. Jam and butter crocks, and much to my delight, a coffee machine with an excellent selection of really good coffee. The fridge was stocked with yogurts, orange juice, bottled water, and, always my definition of a luxurious necessity, real half and half. I didn't want to leave that little house once I stepped inside. And at night, we slumbered in a bed made up with real 100% cotton sheets and a very fluffy comforter. But that was just the food and the luxury lodging. Even though Christine was just about the most gracious host we've ever met, and the accommodation looked like something out of a magazine, for some reason it didn't feel like a place where you were scared to sit on the sofa. And I don't know how she did that, but it felt comfortable, inside and out. When she'd originally said, "I'd be happy to put you up on your visit," we were incredibly grateful and really rather touched, and we probably would have been really happy in a hayloft, but I'll tell you, I will be dreaming of this place in my more stressful moments over the upcoming months. All that and a bag of chips, as they say. But when we did venture outside to the farm that first morning, the Better Homes and Gardens thing just kept going. Next month's episode of Vicarious Agriculture will soon be up on our YouTube channel for you to see the Hulse Hill Farm visuals for yourself, but until then, I'll tell you, this farm was lovely. The aforementioned chicken coop showed where the colored eggs originated and explains why the hens laid so well. I'd produce two if I lived in such a pretty hut. The pig pasture was a perfect patch of mud and ground cover and tree and grass and hayfield steel hut to keep the two porcine critters as happy as possible, which was a proven thing because they played tag with each other in between bouts of napping and eating grain and squash. By the way, if you've seen a pig pasture, you know that's a pretty tough thing to keep it looking anything like anything other than a wasteland, but this one managed to avoid that. And pig tag is something I gotta catch on film. It is really hard not to smile. There were rows of flowers out front, and they're still blooming, even in October. They're guarded by Willie, the extremely fluffy big black shepherd, who seemed to know what was going on every corner of the property at all times, I think. He did take a moment or two every few minutes to come by for a scratch, or maybe it was to check on me. I don't know which. Bella, the pot-bellied pig, would pretty much be a podcast all on her own. But I will tell you that not only is she the very vocal meet and greet committee, but she also has a nose like nobody's business. We had a hysterical incident where I was an idiot and I left my purse on the ground behind the hill when we went to film in that little farm store, but I neglected to think about the four flavors of lip balm and the tube of lotion in my bag. Bella had found it within minutes and had decided to take off with it, but only after some investigational rooting about and then a running attempt to cache it for further study later, when she realized her misdeeds had been exposed. Rick and I finally managed to separate Bella from the bag, and as I was laughing hysterically by that time, Bella was snorting along with me. She has a serious sense of humor, that Bella does. After all of that, you might think that those are the things that we went to Hulse Hill for in the first place, or maybe just to lose all semblance of self-control in the farm store. Wait, Rick, why are you leaving again? But no, none of that. Our original purpose was to meet the cashmere goats. And I will tell you now that if you haven't petted a baby cashmere goat yet, you don't know what soft means. It's like running your fingers through a cloud, except maybe it's a little bit softer than that. So today, you'll get to meet them, the deliciously touchable things that they are, and listen to Christine talk about some of the ways we can blend both fiber and people together to utilize the strengths of both. So now, I'll let you finally hear from the gracious Christine Hulse. This woman calls herself retired as she's no longer working as a counselor in the school system, but she is not a lady who sits on her sofa all day and directs the staff to make the yard look lovely. She gets a little bit of help from a female farmer down the road who splits farm chores at times, but I gather that Christine does the majority of the effort in making the flowers and the barn and the fields and the animals on that little spot of heaven look like it does. She runs that amazing B&B and a highly tempting farm store where she sells not only her products, but products for others in her community. And she also has a company called Clean Cashmere, and she runs it with her partner. And that is her version of retired. Oh, and she's on the board of directors for the Cashmere Goat Association. If any of you have been involved in the day-to-day struggles of making a nonprofit a viable thing, you understand the amount of work that is. It is not for the faint of heart. We're going to meet up with Christine at the New York State Sheep and Wool Festival this weekend. She will not be bringing her animals this year, but instead will be wearing one or two of her many hats in representing both Clean Cashmere, her business, and the Cashmere Goat Association, her passion project, in their booth. Retired from the field of education, my foot. I have the feeling that from now until the day they bury her in one of those glorious pastures, she will educate and beautify and make people feel completely at home, no matter what you call it. Here is the wonderfully generous Christine Hulse. Thank you for 3 days of bliss that will long be remembered.
I'm Christine McBrady Hulse. I am owner of Hulse Hill Farm here.
This gorgeous piece of property.
Thank you. Yeah, we actually, we have a farm stay. So a lot of the support from the farm, it's kind of like an educational model, mm-hmm. which I love. Well, I'm a former educator.
I was going to say
fits
that goes
in.
Yes.
And so I was a school counselor, actually, elementary and middle school for 31 years.
So you were in the trenches there.
I was. I loved it. I went right through COVID and everything, and I loved it. I loved the educational piece. But one of the things that I kind of got stuck on as a counselor helping with kids in school is that so much of it wasn't experiential. And so when I got involved in farming, which I had a little history growing up with some farming with 4-H, I was like, you know, this is your classroom. Like, that you can teach everything. You teach math, science, everything, history. So so when I retired, I really worked on bringing it forward. And we were a farm stay for a couple of years when I was teaching during the summer. But so I developed this farm stay model where families can come and experience the farm. And then, of course, my primary livestock on the farm are the cashmere goats. So
cashmere goats, but that's not your only livestock, because I'm looking at this gorgeous chicken coop here behind us, and you also had a little pig Bella that came up to greet us. That's hysterical. They're standing there, all of a sudden, a large pig pet me. Did I translate the pig talk correctly?
Absolutely. That's Bella. She's a rescue pig from the site that called Pigtopia, where it's just like a dog. They bring the pig, you know, across country. So she was rescued, and she's become part of our family. And so we have a couple of rescue animals here, but because the farm is really, for me, supposed to represent balance and sustainability and what a homestead farm would look like as far as growing your own vegetables, your own animals. And also, you know, supporting yourself, you know, because how can you make a little bit of income on a farm so that you're not putting all your money into it and losing it? So that's been the goal for me on this farm, is actually to break even and maybe make a little extra on this farm. And the farm stay helps with that, obviously, and doing educational events. So it's been a great model. It's a hard model to work with as far as time.
It is, and you have to really be committed to it. I always look at the word sustainability, and I love it, but everybody, I think, shorts that word. Yeah. They say, it's some touchy-feely thing in nature and for the tree-hugging populace, which I'm probably one of them. But it really is applicable to business and life in general, because all you want the thing to continue in a natural cycle, whether it's a business, whether it's a family, whether it's a farm, because if not, there's this constant drain that makes it impossible to sustain in the long run.
Can I pay my feed bills? Can I pay my grocery bills? Can I pay my fuel bill? I mean, everything to keep this farm going. I think I view that as sustainability. There's sustainability with the land and the soil and all that as well. But that is a big piece of it for this farm, all those moving pieces. And so that's where our farm shop, which we can walk down, I'll show you. But that's where the farm shop came into, is just, you know, the more direct you can offer your products to customers, and they can have that transparency of like, oh yeah, I see right up there where your fiber comes from. I see right where your eggs come from. I see right where your squash comes from. And and people love, I mean, they are so supportive, so supportive.
You're in these days, that niche marketing thing and the co-op thing, you're buying the story of the people behind it and the meaning. You feel like I'm contributing back a little bit, or I have a little bit of that meaning inside of me. It's kind of like teaching, right? I mean,
it absolutely is. And the gift of it is, which I find, is the customers, you know, you're in the business of storytelling, is you get to find out their story and how you fit into it. And I absolutely love that. That's what drives me.
Yeah.
I get so much strength from their stories and what brings them from the guy that comes every Sunday to get the donuts for his father to bring him to the nursing home or whatever it is. It's really great. This is our little farm shop
Farm shop, my foot. This little, is gorgeous. Look at this.
Oh, we opened this during COVID to, again, just get our. We had so much food that we were growing, and so we said, well, let's just put it in the shop. And then I sell my fiber in here too, direct. You know, so we sponsor like a lot of local artisans. So like I have an actual a veteran who makes all these woodworks. He's a retired veteran. He does all the bowls he makes, the planters. I have another woman in town who makes the aprons. So I don't do everything here. We do the produce. I do the any of the yarn, the cashmere jewelry, But, and it changes seasonally then. In the winter, we'll put more fiber out and knitted items and things like that. So we switch it over.
So why did you decide to be the one that leads the pack and will help all of our local farmers in
one
place?
Well, one was my location. Yeah. We're so rural here that a lot of farm shops, when you're tucked on a road, you just don't get the traffic. So that's what I was like, hey, we've got the spot. This was supposed to be a sheep shed originally. And then we decided that I was good with the amount of animals we had, because we just, with our acreage that we had. So we turned it into a store, yeah. And then I just started talking to a lot of people who just didn't have a way to get their products out there. So, and we just basically, you know, they put their items here, they stock them, and they get paid directly for them. So we just offer the space.
And you are obviously beautiful at the presentation component.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, very artistic.
It's
person.
Yeah, it's been fun. And I do baked goods. We do, you know, the donuts. We do a lot of fresh baked goods, so that's fun. And so we started brainstorming a model that, you know, we could basically work with farms. And we came up with Clean Cashmere. So we started that, probably a good 3 or 4 years ago. And we launched last year in Rhinebeck with our first yarn line, 4 yarn lines, actually. And we started working with farms directly and seeing if they wanted to join Clean Cashmere as part of our herd.
So you're sort of a little co-op kind of thing.
We are. We are. We actually profit sharing. So, you know, as when the company makes more, our farmers get paid more.
So when you say profit sharing, you're probably not talking about millions of dollars.
No, and we're not even talking time. We're talking actually just fiber profit. So we're talking about the cost of the fiber and the processing and the, you know, putting it out there, the advertising. So, yeah, we're not even talking time at this point. Yeah. But the farms do get, one of the models that we came up with was a lot of times with fiber in the U.S., you send your fiber to a mill, it can take 6 months to a year to get processed. You don't see any income from that fiber until a year later, or maybe even 2 years later. So it's not, we talk about sustainable, it really does not work to support your farm, you know, when you're not getting any kind of income back for 2 years. So what we do is we tell farms the minute the fiber hits the mill and it's weighed, as soon as you mail it in, we pay you. Mm. So we pay you. So they get paid instantly. And so that was an important part of our model, is making sure that farms get paid directly as soon as the mill gets the fiber. And I'll be honest with you, we're not pulling an income from it. Everything we make in this company right now, we're at the foundation stage and we're going to our second year. Everything that we make, we're putting back into the company, whether it's through the social media or the farms, you know, and whatnot. Yeah.
Yeah. But you can't, just because you feel that way about the social imperative or the moral imperative doesn't mean everybody else can feel that way or can afford to feel that way. Mm-hmm. So if you wanted people to be part of your group, you kind of have to give them something because it can't just be this big, I guess it could be this big nonprofit, but when it comes down to it, you want this to be a functional, sustainable
system. Yep, absolutely. Yep. And actually this year we looked at our sales and it's going to work. It's going to be a successful model if we can keep at it. And you know, slow growth. Yeah. We cannot, in this industry, you cannot do, it's just not feasible to do it. So slow growth is a good thing for us.
Yep.
One farm at a time and bringing them on. And the other part of our model that's a little different is that versus a co-op is that a part of our herd, co-ops do this too, but we do a lot of mentor and training. So we have our herd gatherings once every 2 months and we'll bring in somebody to talk about combing. Or we had David Shaw from New Zealand Cashmere at our last herd gathering via Zoom, and he talked about their model and what they're doing in New Zealand. So it's really to make our farmers feel like, you know, we're offering something for them too, outside of just buying their fiber, helping them reach their goals for their farms.
Yes.
That's important, whether they want to get bigger or not get bigger.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah. I believe, and my husband can correct me if I'm wrong here, but I believe we were talking maybe with something about the Cashmere Association about videos, and we hadn't quite gotten to that stage yet. But in the meantime, you heard that we were going to the UK this year.
Yes. Yes.
And you had a quick recommendation for us. You've got to go to Lunan Bay, because that's someone you follow. And it was the most wonderful recommendation. I have to say thank you so much for that. Because boy, that was Jillian's just, she's fantastic. And I think I listened to her a little bit, but really I was just hearing the lilt of her voice. because they're right on the ocean.
Her location.
Oh, Scotland's gorgeous, but it's a very, it's a little bit lonely. It's like many places in Montana or, you know, places that have a lot of space to them. You have to be very comfortable in your skin. And you, and it's obvious she's a very dedicated, strong woman that does what she wants. And it's interesting to me how many women in farming we find that are representative of this. But the things that you've talked about so far, you know, she has taken her goats and she's run her business. She has a scientific background a bit. But she's also put goats in the educational system a little bit. So it's kind of funny how one of your main components is education. And she's done the same. She's using goats. I don't know if you've...
And even our companies, you know, she's trying to bring back the whole Scottish. And when... So there is also like a Kevin Bacon moment here too. Let me tell you, as far as we're connected, which is kind of cool. So so I started following them because anybody, obviously, with Kashmiri, I'm like, ooh, more about them. But ironically, I started following and she was great. And we were dialoguing back and forth. And I was looking at her mission and what our mission is. And we were talking about database and how to keep track of data on our... genetics of our goats. And then I saw all of a sudden she had somebody doing some test knitting for her, and who I knew, actually my husband, one of his former would be contractors that he used to work with, his name's Gary Downs. Well, his wife Natasha was doing test knitting for her. And I said, I know Natasha's been on my farm. She's come from Scotland to visit. She's actually Russian. Her husband's Scottish. But anyway, so when I saw, I reached out to Natasha. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. You just tested the hat for Luna Bay. She's like, yeah, I'm really good friends with them. I'm like,
I know them.
So yeah, so it was really, really cool that.
It's a sad irony that we were having the same conversation with her over there about things that happen in many, in many ways, almost exactly the same way here. You know, they are trying to have Scottish cashmere be a thing again, but the infrastructure is the problem. And you know, think about it. Here, how many mills do you have to choose from when you want to have a mill process your fiber? Do you have 50,000 mills in the States here?
Right. No.
How many do you have?
No, we just were on a conference call with our mill, which we are putting our fiber in now for next year. You know, you have to do it in a year in advance. And it's very, very limited, the milling. And that the processing is a huge issue. And the mills are great. They know what they're doing, you know, but a lot of them are one-man shows. Yeah. You know, they might have two or three people working for these mini mills, and that's it.
So. But there used to be quite a few, and they've sort of died out, correct?
Yes. Yep.
Yeah. We were at one a couple years back, Mount Meadow, out in Montana, Wyoming. Yeah, she's right there. They're right there on that edge, and they're a fairly large thing because they have all of those sheep that come out of the northern ranges, and they process chunks of wool at a time. But again, you look at this and you think, large or small, the mill is sort of not a dying thing, but it is something that is endangered, very definitely, because it's been replaced by all of these artificial fabrics, and if you can just weave something in plastic, and it doesn't feel the same, but it's difficult to compete with that whole plastics industry,
right,
in a fiber, in a smaller way.
But let me tell you what I've learned, one of the pieces that we're missing, and I can't understand why, so maybe somebody can teach me, is that everywhere else in our society, technology has taken a hold and moved things fast forward. But for some reason in the milling industry, and I understand you mill something, the concepts are the same, but we haven't had any technological advances in the milling industry in forever. Like, I mean, if you look at these machines, the machines have not, I mean, there's no, you know, as far as technology, very little technology growth has happened in that area. We're still using machines that are very similar to what they were in the 1800s and early 1900s.
Is that because they're made better? I mean, I hear those old machines are, if you can find an old sock machine, you grab it because they're made in a way
they're made so great. But my thinking is more so this, is that there's been so much more money and technology in other areas that in the fiber industry, in the small mills, I mean, the engineering students and the tech students aren't, the colleges are not looking at that arena right now to make any kind of technological gains. Huh. I would love to see a college that has, you know, an engineering, you know, department look at how we can start advancing mills in the U.S., you know, to process fiber faster, or, you know, and help these mills make some gains, because I do believe the equipment, probably the foundation equipment, will stay the same, but I think there can definitely be some improvements.
So I would say there's a great thing for New York or Texas too, because Texas is sheep and wool capital, but
Texas A&M.
I believe the Angora, the gentleman with the Angora mm-hmm. Association was telling me that they have huge warehouses down there that mm-hmm. that are processing fibers for Angora goats too. I mean, I didn't know that until a couple years ago, that small ruminant capital of the United States is basically Texas.
A lot of Angora gets shipped to South Africa, I believe, to be processed too, because they can't do it here, the amount. So, but I would like to see, you know, my son's a tech major right now at RIT, and I was just like, gosh, get some of these kids together to be looking at the milling process and how, and this is where I see it. I see as a model, and I'm probably going way off on the beaten path, but my vision would be something like, if something could be created where we had regional mills, like my farm, I could have my barn and I can have a small regional mill that I could afford and wouldn't be $500,000, $600,000, but I could have a dehairing machine that would cost me, let's say a dehairing machine would cost me maybe even $20,000, $30,000, that I could get other farms to bring their fiber here regionally, dehair it, and then my processing, I can have yarn in probably 3 months. So it's these little, I mean, the dehairing for us is the biggest issue. Mm-hmm. The dehairing takes a long time, and you have to do it in small batches, sometimes even by farm, to get the consistency. Mm-hmm. That would be a huge piece to have smaller, affordable dehairing machines for regional farms to use.
Well, maybe New York is the place, because I know that it's always hysterical to me that people think New York and they think the city, and that's kind of what New York is. Mm-hmm. But New York goes out, even outside of the city, upstate, which is anything, you know, 20 minutes out of the city is upstate, really. In a way. So that's everything all the way up to, gosh, Canada.
But the Hudson Valley, has huge textile and fashion happening. So, So feel free to pass that idea along, that we're looking for a dehairing or processing that can be machines that small farms could work together on affording, so that we could do it. And I don't want to take the mills out of business, but I'm just saying what it would allow us to do is take a step out, so that we could still send our fiber to a mill and they could get it, you know, in the process much faster.
I don't think you're going to send the mills out of business if you're waiting a year to get fiber back. Yeah. They're overloaded as it is. Yeah. So there are moments where I believe the textile industry could, in a way, be reborn, like the hops industry kind of started.
And you're right, there has been legislation right now that's in, you know, in being activated, which is great on that front for sure.
Yes.
We'll see. Yeah. I mean, one of the things I love about our company too is that we, like I went down to the Hudson, we do a blend of a 50 Merino, 50 Cashmere, and our Merino's from the Hudson Valley, from this great farm. I get to go pick up the fiber and feel it. And and our Cormo actually came from a farm in Michigan that we paired with for a collab, and another farm in New York State. So, you know, we're using all natural fibers from either right here in New York State or other farms within the United States for our blends.
So now on the technical side of things, I love fiber, but I really don't know it as much about it as I'd like to. In terms of blending sheep and goat, mm-hmm. or alpaca mm-hmm. and goat, or alpaca and sheep, or whatever it happens to be, is it kind of like... we went to Oregon to the cheese place, and they were doing a cheddar that was a sheep and goat blend, and I thought, gee, that's sort of interesting, but other people had not done it, and I think, is there a reason why they didn't do it? Because the cheese was pretty good, but they said there's something about that, I think it was that, or maybe it was the sheep and cow blend. Anyway, whatever it was, that was not commonly done. In fiber, is it commonly done to mix different animals?
Or? Yeah, it hasn't been, but now I think you're seeing much more of it. I mean, you think about farms, they would have just raised one species, right? Mm-hmm. They do Merino, or they do they do one specific to their farm, and so they wouldn't do multiple types typically. But now I think what's coming more so, even the cashmere, I mean, 20 years ago, the CGA, all those farms were doing 100% cashmere, and they would never thought about, I could mix it with Merino, I could put a little silk in there. There wasn't a crossover or communication with the folks who were actually using it in the textile industry, which have the whole, their belief is you create something for what you're going to use it for. So, you know, that's what the makeup should be. So if you're doing 100% cashmere, you want it against your head. If you're looking at a hat to keep you warm, but you need something lofty and a little waterproof, you might mix it with alpaca and you might mix it with or wool. That's going to help you do that. So it's all based. So now it is much more common for people to be like, let's come up with our own blends that fit what garments you're going to, you know, what it's going to be used for.
Yes.
The practicality of it.
Yeah.
And that's because now there's more communication with the textile industry, I think, with that.
So are you limited in terms of cashmere? Does it really do that one thing? Because it does really, really well. It's soft and gorgeous.
Right.
Is it one of those that lends itself nicely to mix with a
So it's something that's, you know, of course it's like supposedly eight times warmer than wool. You know, it's got that capacity. And that's because it has such extreme crimp. So you think of the crimpiness of each of those fibers. When you put them together, it locks into this really nice seal to hold the heat. Versus other fibers that have don't have as much crimp, right? So it's very, very warm, but it's not super waterproof either. So, you know, it's not something that you're going to use as far as moisture all the time. But it does lend itself, and the blends lend themselves. We do a merino blend. We do Cormo is a sheep that has a lot of loft to it. We do a Cormo blend. Not many people, I don't think anybody else is doing a Cormo blend. We love it. It's great. It's loftier, super warm. And the cashmere gives it super softy, buttery feeling.
How is it to knit?
So we have different, like the pure cashmere is a fingerling weight. Our Americana Cormo is what we call our sport weight. And then we have a sock weight, which is the merino. So again, it depends on, are you want to do your mittens? You want to do a hat? You want to do a scarf? So that it's lend itself to different patterns and things that we do. So we have a cashmere club. So we have a quarterly club, which has been really fun. We have like 25-30 people in it right now, and every quarter we send them a kit, and it has a different blend yarn and a pattern in it. You know, it's a big reveal surprise, but we try to feature the different yarns in each kit, so our club members get a chance to knit with some different blends.
So now you are going to be completely creative, because instead of being in the breed barns this year at Rhinebeck, you are going to be in your shop area, right?
Yes, we'll be with the Cashmere Goat Association and other farmers that belong to the association with their products, which are amazing. And people get to meet those farmers because some are coming to work in the booth. And then we sponsor, Queen Cashmere sponsors part of the booth, so we'll have our yarns there as well. I think we have at least 10 to 15 farms represented with Queen Cashmere.
Fantastic.
With our yarn. Yeah.
Boy, such interesting faces, don't they?
They do.
You can just tell them looking at you going, who are you? Look at this face. Something about goats is very cute.
They are. That's McCabe. He's the most curious little guy. What's up, guys? You talking? So every goat, you know, all our farms here, we all have these stories of these animals, but this is Bernadette. She's actually originally from Springtide Farm in Maine, in Bremen. A lot of this genetics is actually from Bremen, Maine. She specializes in breeding silver cashmeres. But Bernadette was born during COVID, and her mother passed away immediately after from a complication, and so she was a single. And Wendy, the owner of the farm, I know they're so fuzzy here.
I'm sorry, I just touched that. Wow.
They're fluffing out a little too now.
Oh, go ahead
and
talk.
Wendy, wow. Well, Wendy got a call, a neighbor of hers, you know, they live in a pretty rural community, a neighbor of her, George, was on the side of the road, and he got hit by a car by drive-by. Right before, March of COVID, so right just when it started. He came home after being in the hospital with some surgeries to fix him up, and he lived on his own, and he had no pets, and he said to Wendy, do you have a bottle baby I could just love, and, you know, like, you know, no one's around, and I'm so lonely. And so she said, we'll try, I'll bring Bernadette, you can keep Bernadette. So he had Bernadette from March until June, I think, And there were sightings of George. Oh, gosh. Oh, gee.
Oh, wait. You're going to lose that cord. We have lost a cord to a goat.
I bet you have.
Yes, we have.
So Bernadette went to live with George, and then George took him everywhere in the pickup truck. Bernadette went to the store. She went, like, everybody's, like, you know, driving around, and she was living in the house, I guess. And then she came back to Wendy's farm, and, you know, they've got all these big, beautiful rocks in Maine, and Wendy called me, and she goes, I've got a goat for you. I've got a goat because this goat has been away from my farm and is not acclimated to my herd, and you have a small herd. So we took Bernadette in.
And this obviously is a bottle baby. Look at
bottle
that.
Bottle baby. And these were her two first kids. This is the first time she's been bred. But
This, it was just, I didn't mean to interrupt you when you were speaking there, but touching the babies, the kids, it's just phenomenally soft.
So and this is when you're talking about the science, right, of fiber. So with Queen Cashmere, and I've learned this just because my partner Heidi is such a knitter, and I'm the farm, you know, educator, and she's the actual knitter. But we take the kid cashmere, then when we comb these guys in March, their cashmere is going to be super soft, but it is going to be shorter than it will when they grow up. Mm. It'll be a tad shorter. And because it's shorter, to make that kid to use this cashmere in yarn is going to make it potentially a little not as strong. So what we do is we blend all of our kid for all our farmers. We say, you know, separate your kid cashmere when you comb, and we blend it with merino. We do a 50-50 kid cashmere. And then that way it's beautiful, but that merino adds the length for us. It works great.
So this is, if I understand it correctly, you're talking about the equivalent in sheep of a staple length, which
exactly.
is the length of the fiber, yep. and the more elasticity it has, mm-hmm. because if you pull the strand, whether it's in a sweater or elsewhere, it has enough length to absorb that that pull. Is that correct?
Exactly.
So it makes it stronger in
yeah.
general?
So, I mean, there you have to have at least 1.25 inches of length to be cashmere. It has to be that long, 1.25 inches. Theirs will be 1.25 inches, but it will just be probably 1.25 inches. In another year, their staple length will grow to almost 2 inches. So, but that first year when the first, you know, crop of cashmere comes in, it is a little shorter.
So this is the, when they get older, it's not just the length, it's differences in the middle here too, correct?
Yeah.
The difference, the fiber is softer when it's closer to the skin on the goat?
Not necessarily. It can be that, you know, I know, yeah, you're saying the microns, you mean as far as like,
is
the crimp.
Like in yaks, you might have something where they have the guard hairs on the top,
mm-hmm.
and then when you get closer to the skin, there's a layer that's actually quite a bit softer. So are goats not like that?
No, I would say with goats, it's really about the middle of their body, and over this way is where you're going to want to get the best cashmere. You know, typically under on the side, the neck and the back area is not something you're going to harvest from.
Okay.
With the guard hairs and the cashmere itself.
So how, in terms of the dyeing, I'm one that really loves natural colors, so I'm not a huge dyeing person, but in terms of dyeing cashmere from the goat, how does it take?
Oh, you know, it's just like any other fiber. I mean, it takes really, really well, but I also love the color of the base of the fiber. So like your taupe, my black goats up there have like a taupey fiber to mm-hmm. them, their cashmere, which absorbs like reds and blues and gives you like a really deep hue. The white fiber, you know, dyes really well if you're going to do pinks. You know, so you are going to pick different color base colors for if you're going to use a dye, even a natural dye. We just collaborated with Mitchell Wool, and they do only natural dyes. And they combined our cashmere with their Cormo. It came out beautiful.
Again, this is sort of like the astrophysics component to it. You have to not only figure out what you're going to be making, you have to figure out how the dye is going to take.
Yeah, and what color your base is going to be. Do
yes.
you want to use your white fiber to dye that color, or
yep.
do you want to use your taupe, or you want to use your dark, dark black? I mean, there's only a few shades with the natural fibers, but...
Now, in terms of keeping goats, because you have to, you know, you have to keep these guys healthy. I know that nutrition is super important mm-hmm. in fiber production, and it makes a big difference in the actual product itself, because it's just like human hair.
Yeah.
Your hair and your nails are going to show how healthy you
yep.
are, right? So in terms of keeping cashmere goats. I know that worms are an issue with many goats, and obviously their hooves, your beautiful hoof care on them, but you do have to make sure that you take care of the hooves.
Yeah,
and the teeth on the goat, right?
Yep.
Anything else? If people were saying, "Hey, I wonder if I could raise goats," what you really have to?
Yeah, the parasites. So these guys were both bred this year, so moms, and so the moms tend to have like a higher parasite load because they're milking, you know, and she had triplets, so even more so for her, we had to watch her really carefully because their immune system gets so taxed. But yeah, the hoof care, and you know, being in New York, unlike my friends in Maine who have those rocks in the pastures, the hooves get naturally worn down like deer. We do not in New York. Like, I don't have rocks on mine. We just have pastures. So, so trimming every 6 to 8 weeks, usually the hooves have to be trimmed.
Yeah, they seem to gravitate toward the rocks here.
They will.
Is it because it's the high point and they want the high point, or is it the rock itself?
Anything, tables, yeah, anything up high is their natural instinct to be up high for sure. It's what they love.
Again, that brings nature inside and makes you connect with it. I keep touching your arm because I'm thinking of the sweater in my head.
Yeah.
When you touch that sweater, you know, just like your little bracelets, when you touch them, you feel.
Mm-hmm. And I think, too, it grounds you as a human when you have that connection with things. You know what I mean? It's not like a superficial thing. You know, it actually sticks in the brain.
I like the way you put that. It grounds you as a human. That's true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we need, today more than ever, in our fast, busy, busy lives, we have so few things that ground us, I think. And I think that's, too, why people are coming back to ag and wanting to buy more things that are ag-related directly, for sure.
Yeah. I'm going to leave it on that one, but say that if you do want to ground yourself, this is the place to do it.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
I absolutely, the tiny house that you're putting us up in is lovely, but this whole place is so full of peace and warmth and just... It's just delightful. I'm really hoping that maybe we're going to take you up on one of those little farm classes next summer.
Yeah.
When it's not 40 degrees out.
Yeah, I know. Thank you.
So much.
It was a pleasure. Pleasure having you. Thank you for letting me show you around.
Well, we look love forward it. To hay tomorrow. I won't buck hay, but he might.
We need a bale counter. That's what we need. I need somebody to sit and count bales.
If you liked our podcast, please subscribe. This is how we keep going. And please ask your friends to join us. Please also feel free to post any comments or questions to our social media sites. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook under Backyard Green Films. Thanks again for listening.
We want to thank Christine for joining us today. And if you'd like to find out more information about the Wholesale Farmstay, her business, Clean Cashmere, or the Cashmere Goat Association, please follow the links in our bio. We'll see you next time with another adventure. You have been listening to Agriculture with your host, Alara Bowman. Please tune in for upcoming episodes from our travels. I'm Rick Bowman, your behind-the-scenes editor. Until next time. This has been a presentation of Backyard Green Films Productions, all rights reserved, copyright 2023.